first, but we would always say if you could treat them as you would want to be treated, and to use the proper terminology as, a person with a disability, a person with a spinal cord injury, a person with cerebral palsy, whatever that might be. But we would love for them to really use your first name if that's possible after you get to know them. And, I think a lot of people with disabilities sometimes don't want to, they want to blend into the background because they already think that they stick out more than the non-disabled community. So a lot of times they will not speak up for themselves. So we try to educate non-disabled individuals about the proper terminology for addressing those of us with disabilities.
Awesome. Thank you. Amanda, is there anything you want to add to that?
I would agree with a lot of what David said, but I would also say that there is a cultural difference between talking to some people with a who are disabled, who are in the disabled community that don't mind using those other terms like crippled and disabled people. And but it's just asking the person when you talk to them, how would you want to be referred, I think would be the best way. But if you're not disabled, I would go with people with disabilities. Does that make sense? If you're not disabled and in the group of disabled people, I would say go with people with disabilities.
Absolutely. That's sort of the default term when we're talking about it in this kind of context. Yeah. Amy, I don't know if you'll have anything to add on that or if you want to move on to the next question, which is how COVID-19 is impacting service providers. So do you want to speak on that?
Sure, I'd be happy to. I think that with most anyone in this country, service providers were given about 48 hours to completely redesign the way that they delivered services. And I'll tell you, through Kentucky's waiver, there is a pretty large slate of services an individual can receive, whether that be certain therapies or residential or a different set of community-based services. All service providers had to get creative really quickly to be able to, one, adhere to social distancing rules, two, kind of adhere to some of the really strict guidelines that were put in place by our Cabinet for Health and Family Services that apply to individuals who receive services through these waivers. And three, they really had to implement, in a lot of cases, telehealth pretty quickly when they didn't have much experience doing that or necessarily the equipment to do that. So it's been a learning process, and it's been, frankly, a lot of providers have had to completely close down because their services can't be delivered via telehealth or can't be delivered. The services inherently require being in the community or accessing businesses in the community or require physical touch and things like that. So a lot of service providers actually cannot provide services right now, which is having an impact on the individuals who need those services for support. So it's been interesting. Obviously, in places like Lexington and Louisville, where there's great internet access and good cell phone service, some of these things don't have as much of an impact as they do in rural areas, where some residential settings don't have access to internet, or they don't have good cell service. And so it can be isolating for people with disabilities right now. It's challenging, to say the least.
And we'll talk about some of the kind of specific groups within that. Amanda, how has this impacted independent seekers and your people that you work with?
People and going into the day programs and we're not doing that right now because all the day programs are shut down. And it's been hard to get a hold of everybody because we didn't have everyone's contact information, and we're providing a clinical service, so it's got to go through telehealth, and people don't understand what telehealth is, how to keep it confidential, because not everyone in our, not everyone in the groups want their caregivers to know what we're talking about. So confidentiality is an issue in explaining to caregivers they still have the right to privacy, why they're at home, and things like that. It's an issue. It just, and a lot of people, like she said, didn't always have internet access. So we're doing a lot of wellness checks, just making sure that people are okay. And the thing is, most of the people that I work with don't fully understand what is happening, and it's hard to educate them so quickly. And it's hard to do that over the phone, because a lot of the people that I work with have trouble with understanding concepts. So it takes a while for them to get used to something new, which can make these adjustments that much harder. So can you guys hear me okay? Okay.
Now I'm muted, so I can't hear me. David, I want to move on to you. And talking about this, especially in terms of people with disabilities who live and work independently, you know, perhaps with some level of accommodation, how is the situation impacting them? Are people losing access to accommodations that they formerly had? You know, I'm thinking about TARC 3 and services like that. What's that impact like?
Fortunately, that hasn't been... In the very beginning with all this, again, the 48-hour notice of what was going to be taking place, but that hasn't been as much, I have not seen as much as a negative impact. You know, they're limiting the number of individuals that can ride on the paratransit or the TARC 3, which is the smaller buses with the wheelchair lifts. And, of course, the fixed routes they've decreased them a little bit, and you have to wear the mask. And we're concerned about the sanitizing, because they're sanitizing the vehicle, I think once a day. That's after the route's been run in the evenings. So there's some concern about that. And I don't think the drivers, as of a few days ago, were not required to wear a mask. So that's a little concerning for the disability community. But for the most part, I think accessing the community, those who are able to ambulate with no problem, but those who are wheelchair users have pretty much remained somewhat the same, accessing the community. But a lot of times those for the rides and scheduling of that for the paratransit or the TARC 3 can be a little bit of a problem with this. Even some of their people, you know, are not showing up for the scheduling of the schedulers to work and themselves because of illness of either them or their family members. So I think that's put a little strain on the system as well. And, you know, they're talking now about potentially eliminating, I don't know if this is permanent, but eliminating some routes from the fixed route, you know, and I can pass along some information to you about this. Like TARC is going to have an open Zoom meeting or where you can send comments to them at ridetark.org. They're going to do it on May 13th and May 18th. So there's some other issues about that. But I think for the most part, from what we've learned, the community is still available to individuals with disabilities, but again, it's with this COVID, it's just a challenge for all of us, some of these issues.
Thank you. Amy, I want to ask you, for people with disabilities that are living in a home setting, what's the impact on their lives and the lives of the people there in the home with them?
So I will tell you, we've got within the waiver world, we've got three types of home settings. Either you're living with your family at home, or you know, a guardian, or you're living with what we call a family home provider. So that's you're living with someone who's not your family member, who's contracted to you. They contract and you live in their home with them, with often two other roommates, or maybe it's just you, or you live in a staffed residence, which means that there is a staff person working shifts, coming in and out, providing 24-hour supervision, and you're living with, you know, one to two other roommates, a maximum of three. Generally, those are your most common living arrangements. But if you are receiving waiver services through the state of Kentucky, the Cabinet for Health and Family Services has told caregivers and individuals who provide the services that individuals with disabilities access that they're not supposed to be providing in-person care. If it's an absolute emergency and they do provide in-person care, you know, it's got to be justified. A staff person can't provide care to more than one person at a time. And so I'll tell you, it's becoming, there's a pretty well-documented shortage of what we call direct support professionals. They're the individuals who are providing, you know, the one-to-one in-person community-based care. And it's becoming increasingly difficult for, I'd say, people who receive waiver services to get the services they need in a way that's compliant with all the social distancing rules. And just to kind of bounce off what David was talking about with transportation in rural areas in this state where we have transportation brokers and things like that, individuals with disabilities are having a really hard time accessing transportation to get to the places they need, if they're even allowed to go to those places at all. I would say in my experience, access to the community has been limited.
And let me ask you this, and this might, I don't know if you can speak on this or not. Do you think, I mean, should those services be considered essential? Should we be shutting down these service providers and things like that? Or do you have any thoughts on that?
So there are different schools of thoughts on this. On the one hand, you have to balance, you know, the need to the public health need. And certainly that is very important to prevent the spread of COVID-19. Unfortunately, the nature of these services is that you often have service providers who travel around from place to place and helping an individual here in this home and then helping an individual in this setting and things like that. And it's very difficult. I'm not a public health expert, so it's very difficult to limit the spread when we're talking about these services. But I will say that, you know, if you are an individual with a disability who previously, you know, relied upon someone giving you some level of support for whatever service that is, you may not now be receiving that, and that could be causing problems. And I think that people with disabilities are, we've seen over the past, at least on is what's been reported to me, is we've seen an increase in behaviors or what we call critical incidents, because individuals are tired of being at home all the time when they're used to a routine of going to a day training or going to their job or, you know, whatever sort of day or community-based activity they participated in previously.
Thank you. Amanda, I wanted to ask you about that, about the last couple of things we've been talking about, but especially about, you mentioned this, you know, the transition for people. How important is that routine, and how big is this disruption?
Well, I want to speak to some of what you were talking about, because I do receive the waiver. I'm a waiver participant. I receive the waiver through a participant-directed service. So I get to choose who gets to come into my home, take care of me, and doing the things that my staff has to do to help me every day. There is no social distancing in there, because they have to help me do my basic care needs. Like, there's no such thing as social distancing. So, like, providers and other places has to limit where those people can go, or we're at risk to get the virus. Because people with disabilities are just at higher risk, because we have health conditions that make it harder, that make us more vulnerable, and then we have to be around people to get care. And I think that is important. And with during the day where people go into these day programs, and I've worked at 5 different day programs in Louisville, and it is very hard for people to socially distance in these day programs. But I also understand how people are frustrated with staying at home. And so there's no good option here, you know, for people. And so I think it gives us an opportunity to imagine something different within these day service programs that may be a little different than what we expected. Because what these day programs are, they're just other forms of they help people with disabilities. People are around a lot of people. They look like schools almost, where people go in and they do day treatment every day. And it's hard to keep people with disabilities be socially distant because they may not understand the concept of being socially distant to begin with. So those are, I can see where all the options, it is a very hard balance to find, you know, of how to keep people safe and how to help people's mental health at the same time. So, is that?
Yeah, thank you very much. David, do you have anything you want to share on these topics?
I'll try to, yes. I mean, even before this COVID-19, you know, trying to find a reliable assistance, as Amanda said, to give you some very personal care was a challenge. And then you throw in the COVID-19 and being around other individuals, you know, that, again, you have comorbidities and underlying health conditions with your disabilities, and you have to be very careful, but you're reliant on other individuals to get you out of bed, to do your basic hygiene, whatever it may be, bowel, bladder, all that stuff. Even before, it was a challenge for a lot of people, even in Louisville, where you're, you know, the largest city, to find reliable help that would come in when you want it and everything like that and on your schedule, and then be able to pay them. And now you've got the COVID-19, so it just throws a whole nother wrench into an already exasperating situation for people with disabilities. So, and for a lot of individuals with intellectual and developmental disabilities or autism, routine is very important to them. That's what, you know, you disrupt their routine and you're disrupting their life immensely. And that has to deal with their intellectual and disabilities, is that, you know, routine. And when you disrupt that, that's a major disruptor in their life. So all of this is a major problem for the disability community, and particularly those with intellectual or mental health issues as well.
And I want to talk a little bit, and I don't know if you all can talk on this or not, JCPS, you know, how are they handling special education? Can you share anything on that, David?
To my knowledge, they're trying to do the best they can, but, we have a program at the center called Young Empowered Self-Advocates, where we have individuals that are mentors that have graduate from JCPS, go back into the schools and deal with special education classes and tell them their rights and what they can do and about IEPs and Office of Vocational Rehabilitation. And, but a lot of times still in this day of inclusive education, it's still amazing sometimes that we see some students not really being inclusive and really being integrated into the school system like we want to see. I could see it as being a challenge for some of the parents. Unfortunately, I don't deal directly with that. There's a woman that we deal with that does a much more knowledge with that. I wasn't able to get in touch with her before this, but I can see that as being a challenge for some of those parents dealing with some of the situations at home and trying to get some of the lessons plans. But I've not heard of any major disruptors, but again, I'm not the specialist that we have that I could have done that.
Amanda, do you have any insight on that?
No, because I really work with adults after they get out of the school system.
What about you, Amy? We might have to have a separate panel on this subject.
You know, I will say from kind of talking about the provider perspective, there are a lot of children right now who receive services through the Michelle P. waiver who are now at home, whose parents are trying to now become educators, who may not have extensive training in that or know how to do that. I think from what I've heard from teachers, I've got teachers in my family, so it's difficult for teachers to handle the IEPs and accommodations over Zoom sometimes. some individuals with disabilities don't respond well to video conferencing, need more, you know, in-person direction or services. And I'll tell you that right now our DSPs are, some children receive services called CLS, community living supports, and their care workers or DSPs aren't permitted to bill for helping them with homework and things like that. So that's challenging. I would say that would probably be challenging as well for families.
And what's that like for those parents? I have limited experience with this, having had a foster son who had autism, and it was a very intense period of my life. And he was at the time attending summer camp during the day. And I'm just imagining what that's like for a parent that's flipped, you know, that's flipped 100%, where you're now 24/7 the caretaker. Do you have any thoughts on that, Amy?
You know, I would say that it's incredibly stressful. I think parents I've heard from a lot of care providers that parents are really sort of begging for help. But unfortunately, our care providers have been very limited in what the help that they can provide right now, in the ways that they are able to help. So it's a difficult situation. And I think that these parents, you know, their children receive waiver services for a reason. They've demonstrated that they need additional help and support. And it's incredibly difficult, I think, for everyone involved.
Amanda, is that something that you're seeing with any of your clients? I know you're dealing with adults, but if they're suddenly with their caretaker 24/7, is that a change for everybody?
Yeah, I think so. And for sure. And I think what can also happen is abuse and neglect, because they're always together, and it's a very stressful situation, and everyone's stressed out, which can lead to abuse and neglect. And then their caseworker isn't able to come check in on that and oversee. I mean, the caseworker can check in on you and on Zoom, but it's not the same as going to your home or to your provider day program or whatever to check on you. And because that providing time, that time that they're at, that they might be in the day program, is a respite for the parent or a respite for the provider. So there's no break time for everyone involved, but that's happening everywhere, because parents are like able-bodied parents or with their kids, but it makes it worse when you're a person with, you know, have a child with a disability. It can assume just as a person with a disability, with your caregiver being there all the time, could just be stressful, and you don't have an outlet to talk to anyone else. So that's why doing mental health care is so important for people.
Absolutely. And I want to start with you on this next question. I don't know if it'll be your area or not. But, you know, we do know that people living in crowded facilities like nursing homes and prisons are mm-hmm. at higher risk for COVID. Yeah. And there's a lot of people with disabilities who are in similar settings. What's the situation for them right now?
Right now, like the biggest producer of mental health care right now is a prison system for people who have mental illnesses in our prison system. So that tells you that we need to relook at how we do mental health care in the country. But like in Kentucky, I'm not really sure what those numbers are. Probably David would have a better understanding of that. Maybe.
David, do you have a better understanding?
Of the number of in our
For people with disabilities in long-term care facilities and things like that, I don't want to use the word institutionalized. I know that's not the proper word, but for people who are,
I don't have the exact number, but you know, there are a large number of individuals who are in a congregate setting, sometimes with disabilities, and that can be, as we've seen, a country nationwide, that's a breeding ground, unfortunately, for COVID-19, is these people that share close quarters with each other. And that just kind of goes back to the point that at the Center for Accessible Living, we're about community living. If we took some of these individuals that were in institutions, and a lot of times we feel they're unrightly so, and put them in the community-based settings, it's a better quality of life for first and foremost, but it's also economically wise for the state. You pay about $15,000 for the personal care attendant program and some other waiver services a year versus $45,000 a year for a semi-private room and $68,000 a year for a private room in a nursing home. And you talk about Central State or Eastern State or Wendell Foster Home, and you're looking at about $165,000 a year for one individual, where you can serve maybe 10 individuals in the community for that cost. So, you know, we would really love to see, basically right now, 80% of Medicaid long-term care dollars are spent on institutions or nursing homes, and only 20% on community-based services. Yeah. And that's woefully unbalanced and not geared towards individuals with disabilities. And if we reverse that, we create jobs for people who could assist these individuals in the community, create a better quality of life, and have a lot more money to go further for serving people with disabilities and potentially other services. So, yeah, we need to move away from the congregate settings.
Yeah, for sure. And sometimes the day programs are set up are crowded as well. So I think day programs need to be better funded, so we can pay the staff better and get better quality people into these day programs, so people can have more community-based services with more quality in them. So.
And I want to talk about funding in just a second, but Amy, I think you probably have something to add on these last couple topics.
So I will say that obviously my members are all providers of, you know, community-based services, and we're happy to report that, again, I have over 100 business members, and we have not had one positive case in a community-based staff residence or family home provider, just staff residence in this state. So again, those are three-person homes, and there are many thousands of Kentuckians living in staff residences, and not one has been positive yet. So that's a testament to the quality of the community-based care in the state. And it's gone well. And I think that the governor has reported a couple outbreaks in a few of the state-run ICFs. He's talked about it several times in his press conferences. And I don't think that it's necessarily a testament to a lack of quality. I think sometimes, despite our best efforts, someone can be exposed to something. But I just think that it's kind of the nature of the beast when you talk about very congregated settings like that. It just inherently increases the risk of infection. My members were thrilled to report that, you know, no one in a staff residence has tested positive. And so they've, you know, those residential providers have really done a great job in screening their staff and implementing, you know, precautions to make sure everyone's safe and well taken care of.
That's very good news. I want to talk a little, Amanda, did you want to chime in on that?
I want to say that we're talking about the majority of the people we're talking about. There's 24,000 people on the waiver system right now. So that's a very small percentage of people with disabilities in Kentucky. There are people in Kentucky that have disabilities that aren't qualified for these waiver services. And I just want to make that clear.
And there's some long waiting lists for the waivers as well.
8,000 people on the waiting list. And this doesn't include people who just have physical disabilities.
So that's the next point I wanted to kind of get at is, and we've touched on this a couple of places, that services are already not funded at the level they need to be. COVID-19 is having a devastating impact on the economy and on the state budget. You know, we're kind of, nobody really knows exactly how bad that's going to be. From, you know, what kind of impact will that have for people with disabilities if there are just massive budget cuts? Amanda, do you want to start with that one?
If they decide not to fund these programs, or if they cut them back, and they have already cut them back so much that people like myself that are on the MSHLP waiver, there's no way that I would be able to do what I'm doing if I didn't have just support of friends and family in the community, and I'm very lucky. And so the fraction of the people that this funding is serving is very small, and I think that they need to increase the Medicaid budget, but I don't know how that's gonna happen right now. So
yeah, that's kind of it in a nutshell. David, do you what will be the impact for people with disabilities if the budget just gets cut even beyond where it is now?
Well, I've been going up to Frankfort for about the last 16 years of my life, trying to work with legislators on different issues and different programs to try to improve the quality of life. And again, for individuals with disabilities to live in the community as independently as possible. And we're already struggling. I mean, we're cut to the bone of what we're doing now with the services and lack of services, you know, 24,000 people on the waiting list. And, you know, we try to emphasize to the legislators that it's a better quality of life and it's a much more cost-effective way solution to serve people in the community than it is institutions. But, you know, this is really a dire, dire need. I mean, the budget deficit with the pension was already a concern and it would have continued. But now you had COVID-19 onto it. This is really drastic. And a lot of us are really concerned, a lot of advocates and different disability organizations, that when they come back, you know, they unfortunately are reluctant to raise revenue, i.e. taxes or gambling, whatever you want to say, but that they might want to start cutting services in an attempt to try to balance their budget. And we've all been talking about on this thing how already we are barely making it with what we got, and a lot of people are not. And then you're going to add some more cuts to the services that are already woefully lacking. I think it could be a dire situation for Kentuckians with disabilities if some of these, potentially, again, I don't want to scare anyone, but that just looks like the way, because of their refusal over the years to raise any revenue or any other issues that will raise revenue, that's going to be a dire situation for people with disabilities in Kentucky.
Yeah.
Amy, do you have anything to add on that? And are some of your, I mean, are your providers at risk if there's budget cuts?
Yeah, I mean, I have a lot of thoughts on this because I've been on both sides. I've worked on the budget, and I've also, you know, now I'm on the provider side. I will tell you, 2 years ago, the SCL program got a 10% rate increase. That was the first time they've gotten a raise in 14 years. I mean, they're still not getting reimbursed what they were, you know, 17 years ago. They got a cut, and then, so they're still not back up to, you know, 2004 reimbursement. We actually just did a cost study of CAP members, and I will tell you that as a result of closures of, you know, day training centers or just providers who have had to close programs because they can't afford to keep them open right now, our adult day health centers have lost in a 5-week period of time $167,000. Our day training programs have lost $71,000. Our transportation providers have lost $58,000. And our supported employment providers, which is a really important service that helps people with disabilities get jobs, have lost $23,000. That's in a 5-week period of time. And these are providers who are operating, who are barely making it. You know, most of them are just breaking even. So these kinds of losses are devastating.
Mm-hmm. Amanda, did you want to add something on that?
Like I said before, I think this gives an opportunity for the city to reimagine these services that helps the providers, but also puts the individuals safety on the forefront, because I'm afraid that COVID-19 will get in the waiver system when it starts to reopen, and if it gets in one day program, it's likely to get in all the day programs, especially here on mobile, because they all take the same transportation systems and things like that. And we don't know about this virus, so that's what I'm mostly afraid of. And so it's a balance between giving people services and people's safety at the same time.
Absolutely. I think we're going to have to reimagine a whole lot of things when we come out of this. To close up this discussion, I kind of want to talk about what we, you know, at the beginning, we were talking about language and putting, you know, putting the person at the center. And I want to talk about just a little bit about people with disabilities. And, you know, we were talking about this a little bit before we started, how your right for choice is taken away. A lot of times people, when they're making these big decisions or sweeping statements about policies, I think there's a tendency for folks with disabilities, especially intellectual and developmental disabilities, to be assumed not to be able to make their own choices. Amanda, have you had an experience like that through this?
My mom's one of the providers for the state. And when she told me that they told every provider in the state that no one with a disability could ever go back to the grocery store that's on the Medicaid waivers, I was like, that doesn't sound right. I mean, I have my own guardianship. Why can't I make that decision for myself? And if I do it properly, then why can't I do that myself? And so that kind of stuff does kind of it bothers me, because people with disabilities fight for autonomy all the time. It wasn't so great before this crisis, and I don't want it to get worse for people. So,
While we're on this, what's your experience like as an LGBTQ person with a disability?
I was talking to, I have a group of LGBT friends that meet up every Sunday for Sunday dinner, and we can't do that right now. And so we're just kind of stuck, and there's a lot of people in the LGBT community that are stuck at homes with people that don't particularly agree with their lifestyle, but they have to be there because those are the people that take care of them and their families. And so they're kind of stuck, and people who are trans that are disabled are finding it really hard to find the right medication and the right hormones to get during this crisis. So those are mainly just the social isolation is just compacted right now for us.
David, on that question, in terms of people with disabilities and sort of their agency and ability to make choices for themselves, how is the situation affecting that?
I think there's always been a challenge for people with disabilities. There's a misperception or a perception that people with disabilities aren't able to make their own decisions or not up to it intellectually. A lot of times, even if you have a physical disability, there's a perceived notion that we don't know how to care for ourselves or speak up for ourselves. And a lot of times that's ingrained from us from the very beginning sometimes, particularly if a lot of you are born with a disability. Sometimes older parents are, you know, a little more protective and don't let the child or young adult actually get out and make some decisions on their own. So sometimes there's a misperception, and unfortunately that's the way it does go. But, you know, it's a challenge always for the disability community to be recognized. Or as a person myself with a disability, you know, sometimes when I was younger, they would ask, you know, my father, what does he want? When ordering a meal, what does he want? Well, I'm right here. I can tell you what I'd like to eat. that there's a misperception that we don't, have a voice of our own, or because we have a disability that intellectual wise, we can't, speak for ourselves. But that's always a barrier and hurdle that we will continue to face until we, but I think it's improving a lot with inclusive education, and a lot of younger people are really now experienced schools, 12 years of schools with people with disabilities, and like myself, when I was one of two people with disabilities in, my high school. So it's changed a little bit, but there are still those preconceived notions and biases that we're going to have to break down and continue to always work on that issue. So it's not going to go away, but hopefully it will get a little bit better. And what we see people in media, you see people in commercials with disabilities, you see more people in movies. Unfortunately, a lot of times those people in those roles are people who don't have a disability that are portraying people with disabilities. So we work on that all the time to try to get persons with a disability playing that position. So it's always going to be a challenge to continue to be there, but I think it has it's alleviated a little bit.
And I also want to say that with people's understanding that it's a systematic thing that is ableism that is causing a lot of pain for people with disabilities, and not only people with disabilities, but we must look at all people with disabilities who are people of color are more impacted during this crisis. So, and it's harder for them to get services. So I think that's important to know. And the connections between race and ableism is really important to explore, especially during the time of COVID, because we understand that it's affecting Black and brown people in a higher way than it is affecting white people. And so that's an important thing to point out during this time.
Absolutely. Amy, do you have anything to add on that question of agency?
I'll say it will be really interesting to see what the state does moving forward as we see businesses begin to reopen. So whereas you and I will be able to make a calculated risk or make an assessment about whether or not it's worth it to us to go to a business, wear a mask, things like that. It'll be interesting to see if they extend that ability to take reasonable risk to individuals with disabilities. Right now, I'd say that, as Amanda stated, individuals with disabilities really who are receiving services through waivers are not supposed to really be out and about. And there are public health reasons that decision was made. Again, it's way above my pay grade. I'm sure every single, they thought very seriously about that. But again, I think it will be very interesting to see what happens as businesses begin to reopen. On the one hand, there are some individuals who due to an underlying health condition or due to the nature of their disability cannot tolerate PPE use. Maybe they have a sensory disorder that wouldn't allow them to wear a mask, or they have lung issues and they couldn't wear a mask and things like that. And then there are other individuals who, when you explain mask use to them and explain the importance, would be happy to wear a mask and go, be able to go to Kroger or Lowe's or to a park, things like that. So waiver providers really try to focus their attention on person-centeredness, and that there's not a one-size-fits-all approach to this. And so really you have to put the individual at the center of any sort of decision-making. We have person-centered teams, whereas kind of all the care providers get together, including the individual with the disability, and kind of discuss, what the best approach might be. And we, as providers, would always advocate that the person-centered team work with the individual to really take a look at what the complete situation is and make a very highly individualized decision as it relates to that.
I have two questions before we wrap up here. And one is kind of a very tough question. Then we'll have the more positive looking one. And this is Dorothy Stone asked this in the comments as well, or made a comment about this. She also pointed out, as we were talking about this question of agency, that, and I'm going to pronounce this word wrong, but infantilization is always a problem where people are not assuming competence. But then she also points out here that people with disabilities are not getting access to ventilators when they're in critical condition because they have certain non-terminal conditions. And that's something I've heard anecdotally. So I wanted to kind of ask about that. Amy, it looks like you want to speak to that.
We actually worked with Kentucky Protection and Advocacy along with several other organizations to address this issue, and have gotten the Cabinet for Health and Family Services to delete or eliminate any sort of discriminatory language as it relates to ventilator allocation in the event that it became an issue, to make sure that someone's disability status would not play into any sort of evaluation of who is appropriate for a vent and who would need a vent. And so that happened last week, 2 weeks ago. I can't keep my days straight, but recently.
That's really great. David, do you want to?
Well, I agree. We've been working with PNA and Amy and all of them together as well. There's a very large group of advocates that came together to talk about the exam issue of just because you're a person with a disability, you may have a couple of more underlying issues than someone who's in their 30s that didn't. Would you really say that doctor be able to say that because you have a disability is your quality of life a little bit less than that other person? So that was a good thing that we all came together and they did change that issue. So that was a good part for all of Kentuckians with disabilities.
Yeah, that's really good news. Amanda, do you, I think you're muted and I don't think I can unmute you. There you go.
I agree with what they were saying with the statement and everything. And the work that I've done on a national, on like a more national level with that organizer that I've worked with, it's been a national problem around like making sure that people with disabilities get ventilators and things like that. So I don't want to say that it's been kind of, it's been like a problem all across the U.S. that people with disabilities have been concerned about.
Well, it's important that that's why we have advocacy groups like the folks that are on this call to stand up, you know, when those sorts of those discussions are being made, mm-hmm. and correct those things.
Yes.
My last question for you all is, what can people do? Well, sort of two parts. Are there, if people are in need of help, are there resources that they can get? And then what can people do to help? Is there something that folks can do to help out in this situation? David, do you want to start off with that one?
Sure. I think listening to the 4 o'clock calls on Mondays that you all put on would be very beneficial for individuals in the Louisville area to be able to take advantage of. I think, again, in this unusual times, one of the most important things that we've been stressing before all this was the importance of voting. I mean, if you want to make a change happen, you have to get involved in the process. And now that we may be going to absentee ballot, which looks like we are, there are a lot of different dates that have to be made. I will share a list with you that you can put out of different dates that have to be met and certain requirements and what you have to do. But, you know, you're talking 23% or 24% of Kentucky's population are people with disabilities. It's the largest minority and could be incredibly voting, powerful voting block if we got together and started voting. But again, as Amy said in the beginning, transportation is a huge problem. So that's why we encourage absentee ballots, particularly transportation in rural areas. There's non-existent. So the absentee ballot, the mail-in ballot, all those things are incredibly important. And get to know who the candidates are. And unfortunately, we always encourage them when they're out of session is a great time to get to meet with your elected officials and start a dialogue and be a source of information for them, particularly when it comes to disabilities. I mean, I have legislators call me on my cell phone about issues when it deals with disabilities. So to get that resource and that relationship is really important. But now with the COVID-19, will we be able to do that? I don't know. I kind of doubt it. But the importance of voting. I mean, it's just so, so important and imperative that the disability community get out and vote and make their voices heard. I mean, we don't have a lot of money, but we do have the power to hire or fire those elected officials.
Absolutely. Amanda, what can people do to help and make a difference?
I think what David said, the voting is very important. And for another thing that I think is important is for parents to understand how, supportive decision making for their child and things like that as they get older to help them make decisions about their own life, because we're all about self-determination and people being advocates for themselves. And so at first about just educating the community as a whole that this population even exists, just part of it. And then helping people vote that don't normally vote. It's gonna be really hard for people to vote. A lot of people don't even know if they have the right to vote because they don't always have their guardianship. And so it's very complicated to help this particular group of people with disabilities to learn about their rights around political activism and advocacy.
Thank you. Amy, anything people can do to help, people can do to make change, or if people are in need of resources, where can they go?
Two things. I think number one, and the governor talks about this every day, is fill out your census. Kentucky, again, the funding for these programs for individuals with disabilities is 100% Medicaid. The state of Kentucky gets allocated funding from the federal government based on our population and a number of other factors. And they specifically derive that data from the census. So if we want more Medicaid funding for people with disabilities, we all need to fill out our census. That includes individuals with disabilities, you know, also need to fill out their census and need to be supported in getting that done. Protection and Advocacy has done a big campaign about that as well. I would say that if you are a person with a disability and are having issues accessing services, one, you know, communicate your concerns with your care provider, and two, call Protection and Advocacy and see if they can help and see if they can help you work through a solution, because often the care provider's hands are tied by regulation. But that's a situation where P&A can step in, and they've helped several of my members, you know, make sure that individuals with disabilities continue to receive vital services. So those are the two suggestions that I would have.
Well, thank you all three for joining us for this conversation on how COVID-19 is impacting people with disabilities. We have Amy Stade from the Kentucky Association of Private Providers, Amanda Stahl from the Independent Seekers Project, and David Allgood from the Center for Accessible Living. And we've talked about a couple of references and resources and things like that and websites. We'll try to make sure we get those up on our Facebook page and at LouisvillePride.com. Shortly after this. We'll be back Tuesday and Thursday next week at 1 o'clock with more community conversations. I want to get voting in on one of these in the next couple to talk about how people get their absentee ballots and all that with and when the new election is and all of that sort of stuff. And then Friday night, tomorrow at 8, we've got our digital drag show raising money for Louisville Pride Foundation and the COVID-19 Relief Fund. And then David mentioned we do a conference call every Monday at 4 to share information and resources related to LGBT organizations, but also the entire community related to COVID-19, and just sort of trying to figure out what people can do to help, how people can find help. And that's been a really good exchange of resources. And we broadcast a portion of that on Facebook Live, so you can kind of chime in and ask questions or tune in and get updates from people. And I'd like to thank our sponsors that make Digital Pride possible: United Auto Workers Local 862, Norton Healthcare, Connolly Law Offices, Caperton Realty, Evo Mortgage, the Fairness Campaign, and Heine Brothers Coffee. So thank you all for joining us today, and we'll see you next time.
Bye. Thank you. Have a good one. Bye.